Okay, this will be our final hour here with David Brenn as we talk some real science, the future, sci-fi, and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, David. So as Brandon from Houston was talking about, he obviously saw some kind of strange object, probably ours. What do you think?
Well, I think it was very probably. I would wager, 95% that it was probably something of mundane origin, although I do not discount stories of or certainly earthly technologies. Let's bear in mind that it's been 25 years since the Air Force last unveiled one of its super-secret craft to the taxpayers who paid for it. And do you honestly think they haven't been doing anything since then? Any given year, they may show us some of these things that they've been working on. But let's just say, let's just posit that, one of the possibilities is alien spacecraft. I write about such things in my science fiction, certainly. And I would not be horribly shocked if it turned out that we were being visited. My complaint is, again, about their behavior, which is the behavior of complete schmucks.
Lunatics.
Yeah, absolutely. But in any event, they might have their own reason, but it's our planet, so they should be adapting to our rules of hospitality. And that's the fundamental discourtesy of it all. But let me get to what Brandon was saying, which in a much more sympathetic way, and that is we all live in a world where the firelight has spread and the horizons of the unknown are a little farther away from us than our ancestors and their villages of old. But we still have a boundary there, and it would be a shame if it were restricted only to specialists, only to scientists. And that's why I mentioned amateur science before. But the most important thing is we're creating this network of capabilities in our cameras and our cell phones and these instruments in our pocket, which are not only going to have more advanced cell phones every year, but infrared detectors. Soon they'll have chemical detectors, so you'll be able to be part of a neighborhood network that will find pollutants that might be poisoning your family, and you'll join a nationwide network that'll track down the pollutants. You're going to be part of this vast sensor network, and if we do it right, it will be ennobling, it'll be democratic, it'll be empowering of the average citizen. And next time Brandon runs into something like this, or someone else does, he'll whip out this pocket super laboratory thing that he's already got an early stage of, and take that picture, and take those readings. And this is the reason why, UFOs, they're retreating away from this wave of cameras, staying blurry. And that says a lot. If they exist, that says a lot about their motive.
They're coy. West of the Rockies, J.D.'s with us, Colorado Springs, in Colorado, of course. J.D., go ahead.
George and David, excellent subject and segment. And George, I want to send consolidations to you. I know the last few weeks hasn't been that great for you, so I had to slip that in for you. As far as the camera thing goes, hasn't Sputnik been taking images for the last 50 years capable of seeing a golf ball on the ground? And, I mean, I've seen some of the images in their file, and I pulled up my address, see cars in the driveway. And nobody was up in arms about that. When our own government decides to do a little surveillance, if nobody's doing anything wrong, what should they be worried about? And on the UFO sightings, I was kind of curious if David may feel that some of our X-plane projects, and as far as since the 40s when Messerschmitt and Chuck Yeager breaking Mach 1 and X1, we've come a long way. We've made leaps and bounds since then. Maybe some of these sightings could be some of the X-planes.
Well, there's no question. Go ahead, David.
I think that a large number of them are. And I think that I'm getting a little bit miffed that it's been 25 years or so since the Air Force has shown us what our tax dollars are working on. And I think that a large one of the reasons why we're getting self-driving cars is some of the other technology entered into the commercial culture. And I think it's very important that the government share with us enough so that we really feel that we're still in charge. Because if they get too distant from us, even if they are sincere in wanting to protect us from Al-Qaeda and protect us from this and protect us from that, it means that they'll start thinking of themselves as a different species from us. We're the people who have to be protected, but we're not the people who they owe explanations to. So a certain limited amount of government suspicion of government paranoia is just fine by me, even though I consult with the government. They invite scientific science fiction authors back there every year to scare them with stories about things that they've missed. Nevertheless, I think it is important that we apply pressure. We're paying for all this stuff. We should get to share it. And in fact, a lot of that is happening. Now, the spy satellite capabilities from 10 years ago are now in commercial satellites today, and we get to share those images and look down at the ground, not as good as the CIA can, but in 10 years we'll be able to look as good as they can now. The real issue, in my opinion, with UFOs is we have to have the same attitude. And that is, if you're not coming to us openly, then if these stories are true and you exist, then you're jerks.
There is one researcher out there by the name of David Jacobs, David, who believes that these visitations are not good.
Well, look, I am perfectly willing to go the other way, but then again, my skepticism is brought out on that as well. I mean, why would they really want to you know, twirl wheat or disembowel cattle or do probes of lonely farmers? Again, it's hard to imagine a scenario that makes sense for them being called intelligent life. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't some. If you challenge me to write a science fiction story that comes up with a plausible scenario, I'll come up with 12. And there have been some very good ones. Douglas Adams said that they're teenagers, from alien teenagers, teasing us deliberately for the fun of it. In which case, again, because my voice is going out on radio, I now address those kids and say, just you wait until we get a chance to talk to your parents.
David, as you look at science and where it's headed, are you convinced that it's going to do the right thing?
Well, no, I'm not convinced. If you look at human history, at least across the 6,000 years that we know, the one most common trait of humans is our ability to delude ourselves. Now, as a science fiction author, I cater to this because we love to delude ourselves with art, with stories, with movies. You write a good story, and I'm told that mine, you know, are good at this, and that is, you know, you read Star Tide Rising, and you're going to believe in the characters of the dolphins in space, or this or that or the other thing. And so the human trait of being able to delude yourself is necessary to make great art. But the problem is, in these societies we've had for 6,000 years, they were shaped like a pyramid with a few lords at the top. And when the number of decision makers is small, it's really easy for them to delude themselves. And when somebody comes up with the one antidote to delusion, which is criticism, what happens is these kings and lords or rich people would then kill the critics because it threatened their power. And this explains why human history for 6,000 years was just so crappy. Now, we have the world's first civilization in which we have the Constitution, we have science, and we have freedom. And so we send criticism at every corner, and that helps us to find the mistakes. And science has incorporated this. Science is competitive. Science is about criticism and finding mistakes. And if you compare the last 200 years, especially the last 50 years, to the previous 6,000, there's no question that we're on the right path. Doing things logically and calmly and with debate and criticism and science, this has gotten us farther in the last 50 to 100 years than all other previous generations combined. So if you ask me, is science creating the potential for real danger? Sure. But your saying that is part of the criticism process that is helping us to find the dangers so that we can have the positive sum win-win game of getting the good stuff and maybe avoiding the bad.
Let's go to John in Houston, Texas, first-time caller. John, you're on with David Brin.
Yeah, hey, listen, George, what an honor to be on your program. I've got a couple points to make real quick, so if you'll allow me to make them, I will do that and take my answer off the air. But a couple things I just want to thank you personally, George, and all the engineers, everybody that produces your show. You guys just do such an amazing job, and you provide so many millions of people a home. And we're doing the holiday broadcast, I got to tell you, it makes a huge difference in a lot of people's lives. And thank you for that sacrifice. And, okay, so, but, you know, I think there's so many interesting things going on that the commentary is so expansive, it's so elaborate that it's tough to keep up sometimes. And the feelings that a lot of people are feeling with the sense of just so much overwhelming sensory information coming in at once. Right now, it's crazy because you know, we're all experiencing that as time seems to be speeding up. But you know, one of the points I wanted to make about the topic tonight is that one of the most amazing changes in the path that we were on was that technology is a game changer. The computer and the internet, the resources that those provide, they literally allowed every person to instantly become a creator in a way that we have never experienced on a global basis before. And where that's important is that we have basically allowed the American garage, opened it up in such a sense that anybody, anywhere can create anything. And to that extent, you know, the open source movement and, you know, that's going to be a key that, you know, sometimes I wanted to briefly touch on. It allows us to combat the forces that we can see and that we can't see by co-collaborating, by crowdsourcing, by pooling our resources together. It's a game changer. And, you know, that's why we have to do everything to protect it. But, you know, we live in a society globally that where right now we worship knowledge. Our creativity, our ingenuity, these things help us to understand that in this new world, as you know, we develop our consciousness of self and realm versus the old world where they developed spiritual and worldly connections. I mean, the metaphysical ones that you touch on tonight and often in many of your shows, you know, allow us to understand more about what we don't know than what we do know.
Well, there's so much going on here, John. We're almost at the break, but you said something fascinating. And David, what is it about a garage where so many incredible inventions pop out of?
Well, I think it's very interesting that we had two callers from Houston who were both very cogent and very polite, impressively. But also, the notion of Houston is the one city in America, major city, that has absolutely no zoning laws. And speaking as a libertarian, I'm actually a real mix of things, some ways liberal, sometimes ways libertarian, and certainly a heretical libertarian in some ways, though I speak at their conferences. But I like the idea of there being a few places that are that free and open to experiment. And so it's interesting he raised the open source movement, which is the ultimate expression of that ethos, and that is we're going to open up our technologies to average people with the new 3D printers and new computers that are in 10 years will let you synthesize any organic compound. Boy, is that going to put a crimper in the drug war. And human creativity has never been so encouraged in any other human civilization. And then the question we have to face is this dangerous? Will it be very dangerous for us all, for teenagers, to have those molecule Macintoshes on their desktops where they can synthesize any organic compound at will? Boy, they'll come up with wonderful creativity like they do now with apps, but could they also create dangers?
Well, I think they could.
Well, in which case, we're going to have to find new ways of getting the win-win, and that is the positive sum, and that is where we find some way of getting the benefits of all of this creativity while at the same time reducing the harms. And we'll talk about that, I guess, after the break.
You're pretty good, except you came up a little short. We still have some
time. Okay, I'll just mention, I'm sorry, I'm a pro, but I don't have your clock in front of you. I guess what I'll just say is one thing. If there's any concept that the listener should become aware of and read up on, it's the difference between the positive sum game and the zero sum game. Throughout 6,000 years, generally, we lived the way nature does, as a zero sum game. That means if I want to win the game, I have to make you lose. Whereas for 200 years, the Western Enlightenment, especially America, we've tried to develop things that are called positive sum games, and we've got several of them. One is called democracy, another is called free markets, entrepreneurial markets, another is sports, another is science. And in all of these cases, everybody wins. Some people win a little more than other people, but the sum of all the victories is greater than the sum of all the defeats. And if I can urge the listeners to look it up online, the notion of the positive sum game, the zero sum game, if you want to get into it a little deeper, the book called Non-Zero by Robert Wright. Because this is what we're supposedly about. Our great experiment is about making positive sum win-win games where, you know, sometimes the liberals and the conservatives can both win.
Now we're going to come back. We'll take final calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed it is. We're going to come back in a moment with David Brin. We'll take final phone calls here for you on Coast to Coast AM. On our next program, by the way, make sure you're part of the show. We're going to talk a little bit about going to Mars. So make sure you're there. And then a little secret for you on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, David Brin with us. David, I'm going to talk about Mars on my program tomorrow, but you've looked at that as well. What do you think the possibilities are of truly colonizing Mars and then terraforming it?
Well, by far the best science fiction to explore this possibility, very optimistically, but with a lot of drama, is the Mars Trilogy by Kim Stanley Robinson, with three novels called Red Mars, Green Mars, and Blue Mars. Spectacular, epic, covering the colonization of Mars in the future and its terraforming. And as the title suggests, in the first volume, Mars is still red. In the second volume, it's been greened. And in the third volume, it has blue oceans. These are all possibilities. I think it's probably going to be a little harder than Stan Robinson portrayed, but I still recommend that people read it. I have my own some of my own stories that take us to Mars. In addition, there were two recent efforts to get sort of public backing for near-term expeditions to Mars. One is the so-called one-way expedition, where they got people to sign up for that. I signed up for it, but, you know, I'm in my 60s, and I doubt, I think I'm pretty safe from being challenged in that regard. The other one is that in 3 years, there's a wonderful once in 30 years opportunity to send a spacecraft that to Mars that would loop around Mars and come back for free, like you can always do with the moon. You might have seen this happen with Apollo 8 and Apollo 13. That's how they got back alive from the moon. Well, we can always do it with the moon, but we can only do it once every 30 years for Mars. And this one fellow, Dennis Tito, tried to get NASA interested in sending a pair of scientists. They would not land on Mars, but we could maybe go to Mars with humans 20, 30 years early by taking advantage of this cheap way of getting there and back real quick. And my wife pointed out to me that they were looking for older planetary science married couples. And it turns out that pretty much exactly describes her and me. And I would certainly get a lot of writing done on the trip there. But that it doesn't look like that mission's going. And besides which, I know an older planetary science married couple that's much better qualified than we are.
All right, back to the phones we go. Let's go to our wild card line. And Dave is in Memphis, Tennessee. David, go ahead. Dave, you there?
Hey, yeah, I'm here, George.
Okay.
How are you doing?
All right, good.
Good, good, good. Look, that I'm a police officer. I work in uniform patrol. So this conversation is very interesting to me. You know, when you consider the fact that most of the time in uniform patrol, I walk into a room and people can look by my identifiers and tell who I am, what police department I work for, my name, badge number. There's many identifiers, yet I won't know anybody in the room. So when David spoke about a time in the future where I could possibly have something installed in my retina where I could walk into a room and identify the people in the room, you know, based on their identifiers, that's pretty amazing, you know, to think about. The other thing that I wanted to get David to comment on was when he talked about the cameras, because as you know, most of the time when we roll on a scene, we have to turn our cameras on during a traffic stop or a domestic encounter. So to have, and civilians, mind you, can do, they can record the same time they want. So, you know, they're going to get their side of whatever they want to get. But think about a time when I could show up on a traffic stop or a domestic encounter with the knowledge that at the end of this, there would be an unedited recording of this event from the suspect and victim's perspective. I just don't even know how we get there.
Well, what they very, very cogently put, and by the way, thank you for your service, especially since I can just tell from your voice and the way you express things that you're one of the good ones. You're one of the ones who are extending the professionalism of what was for thousands of years a profession of thugs, and then who were reported to the local lord. And then over time, gradually the notion set in that instead police officer should be a skilled profession, a profession of calm professionals. And this is very, very difficult to do because you are constantly under stress and you are genetically no different than a Cro-Magnon caveman. And the temptations to pull out that billy club and use it to you know, settle this guy down the hard way, it must be overwhelming. And you're being asked to do 50 years of transition to professionalism in maybe 5 or 10 years. You're under a lot of pressure, and I constantly urge people out there that while we are celebrating our new constitutional power to record our interactions with the police, not to be jerks about it, because you can see a lot of these things on the web where the guy is shoving the camera at the cop and almost daring him to lose his temper. And these are jerks, and I've been pleased to see that a large fraction of these interactions, the cop just ignores the camera and gets about his job. And over the long run, you're just going to have to adjust to this new world. And it will be better world, because you'll be able to identify people walking into the bar with your little camera at the corner of your eyeglasses or whatever, but they won't be afraid of you unless they've done something wrong, because they'll know that you're not there to be a bully, because you can't be.
Are those days going to change? Because right now people are uneasy. They're uneasy.
People are uneasy for very good reasons. We are in an era of incredible transition. And so far, we've been very lucky. 9 out of 10 of the things that we've adapted right. Like this recent court and administration decision that we have an absolute right to use our cameras to record our interactions with police. More things are being done right than are being done wrong in adjusting to this new world. And given that, that just makes it all the scarier to me that the remaining 10% are not being addressed by calm adulthood and thoughtfulness of a citizenry that's the most educated and the most intelligent and the most technologically empowered in the history of our species. And yet we're wallowing in these nasty dogmatic trips where we're convinced that the people on the other side of the left-right spectrum are evil and horrible, and all the people we don't like, we can learn nothing from them. They have nothing to say that's of interest. This level of immaturity just depresses me, because we're better than that. We can be negotiating with each other. You know, the climate change thing doesn't have to be perfect for us to decide we should at least ramp up energy efficiency a bit, just in case the smart people turn out to be smart after all. Huh. I mean, they might be.
Let's go to Cruz in Odin City, Utah. Cruz, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Oh, hello.
Hi there.
Hi, I was just calling to ask a question about, do you feel like extraterrestrials are coming to the planet to mine proteins and chlorophyll?
Well, David would tell you absolutely not. Now, in terms
I don't see any reason why they would. Certainly, that's a clever notion, because certainly we are mining the bottoms of the oceans and the surface waters and going into Amazon looking for species of diversity so that we can see what chemical tricks these plants and microbes and other organisms have come up with, because that's how we get the pharmaceuticals and all of that sort of thing. But we're rapidly approaching the point, and the aliens certainly should be there, where we'll be able to do it by computer. So the notion that they would need to do more than just a cursory survey of the proteins on Earth seems a little far-fetched to me. Once they've gotten a few million or a few billion samples, and it's really easy to get that real quick, they'd just be able to sit there on the moon or in an asteroid and compute it all. Mind you, look, I don't oppose all scenarios of visitation. I told you earlier that my novel Existence, and by the way, folks can go to my website and watch a 3-minute video trailer that'll knock your socks off. Beautiful artwork for that book. But it's based upon the premise of a kind of alien invasion.
Which you never know. You can't rule it out.
Oh, well, I don't rule these things out. On the level of thought experiment and the level of science fiction. But we have to make a difference between the dramas that we toy with and the things that we consider to be really likely. And I'm in a position where I have to make that determination all the time, every day.
You sure do. Let's go to Tobin in Thornhill, Ontario. Hey, Tobin, go ahead.
Hi. My father and I, we listen and talk about what's on your show all the time.
Well, thank you. I'm glad.
It's very exciting to be on. I want to ask, what if we would have excelled in primarily in sociology to help individuals with their position or inferiority?
Well, we have. People sometimes, around 2000, at the turn of the century, people said, oh, isn't it a shame we don't have the advanced space technology of the movie 2001? And at the time I said, well, you know, it turns out that space was hard. We went to the moon in the 60s because we were crazy. We didn't have the computers, and we lucked out the whole way. No, those floating space stations in 2001, spinning to Strauss waltzes and all that, we'll have them. It's just really hard. But if you watch the movie 2001, there's something else going on, and that is the society that was portrayed in 2001 was kind of nasty. It was this secretive, nasty version of America that didn't trust its own citizens not to panic over the discovery of a magnetic rock on the moon. And dominated by secretive, stuffy white males. And that's what gets them in trouble during the story. If we were to send a mission to Jupiter like that one today, there'd be at least one woman astronaut aboard who'd listen to poor Hal instead of driving him into a paranoid frenzy. No, I think that the biggest changes in society have been social. Look at how many horrible, nasty prejudices our well-meaning parents and grandparents believed because they had been taught them. And 6,000 years of that crap. And we've been cleaning up so many of those nasty old habits just in one or two generations. And it was started by the greatest generation, by our parents who fought Hitler and overcame the Depression, and Harry Truman desegregated the military. And this is where we've made our biggest accomplishments. Nothing makes me angrier than when you hear this old cliche, it's too bad our wisdom hasn't kept up with our technology. I think we've gotten fantastically wiser. And what really depresses me is we refuse to give ourselves any credit for it. We refuse to admit, you know what? We are a better people than we used to be. And we're getting better every darn day if we just pay attention and trust each other.
If. That's a big if, David.
Well, we got to wake up from this damn civil war, because one thing we cannot do is allow America to be torn apart by another damn phase of the same damn civil war. And that's exactly what it is. And the world still needs America, because America is still, as the president said the other day, the essential country, at least for the next 20 years, until we can anchor in these advances in tolerance and diversity and freedom in the world and make English the world language. Until that happens, you know, we cannot afford for America to weaken itself.
No,
the way it
we can't. As we speak, the Australian officials have broken up a terrorist attack possibility where they wanted to behead somebody in Australia. And there's also a video out now saying attack Times Square. When does it end, David?
Well, you know, we are, if you look at it from the point of view of the last 6,000 years, nearly all human cultures were zero-sum. Remember, there's that concept to look up at home. They were macho, and so women were repressed. And they were hierarchical, shaped like a pyramid, with a few lords at the top, instead of the diamond-shaped culture, the middle-class culture that we've created. We're exceptional in many ways, and traditional cultures find us deeply offensive and scary. If you were raised in one of these traditional cultures, you would find nothing scarier than an American woman. And the fact that we give our daughters karate lessons and teach them to look us in the eye and argue with us as equals, this This has them in full-fledged panic mode. And in to an extent, the proper response is to think, is to think, well, you know, that's too bad. You know, I can feel your pain. You know, part of me would like to be macho too. But we've had 6,000 years of this crap, and your method never worked. It never got us anywhere. It never got us to the moon. It never cured polio. You know, it never gave freedom to everybody.
And maybe one day they will. David, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program. Good luck with what you do. I mean, you've done some great stuff here.
Well, sure. And folks who want to visit me, they can visit me at davidbrin.com. Or watch that at davidbrin.com. You can watch that 3-minute video trailer. Yeah, I swear it's the most fun you'll have in 3 minutes with your clothes on.
You got it. David, thanks so much for being on the program. A wild scientist, no doubt, huh? Dr. Frankenstein. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasour, Timothy Benall, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safer.